Good morning. Abua Dembele versus Gonzalez. Ms. Siddiqui.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Sadia Sadiq, and I represent Mrs. Ahoui Dembele in this case. Now, there are two threshold issues on review before this Court. First, did Ms. Dembele make a false claim to U.S. citizenship? And second, was the immigration judge's denial of her motion to reopen, as it was supplemented by the Board's decision, an abuse of discretion? To the first issue, did Ms. Dembele make a false claim to U.S. citizenship? Under the Immigration Act, Section 212A6C2II, any alien who falsely represents or has falsely represented himself or herself to be a citizen of the U.S. for any purpose or benefit under this Act or any other federal or state law is inadmissible. Now, the plain language of the statute states, any alien who falsely represents. The question here, then, is did Ms. Dembele falsely represent, and is there substantial evidence in the record here to support the immigration judge's finding?
But wasn't it within the discretion of the immigration judge to discredit her testimony that she didn't realize she was filing a false passport application? I mean, isn't that what it really boils down to?
Well, Your Honor, the immigration judge never actually made a finding that he discredited her testimony. He took some testimony with respect to what transpired that day at the passport office, but he never made a finding that your testimony is incredible or unbelievable. She was never put on notice that there was going to be issues with respect to what she had already testified to. And what we have here, then, are facts which the immigration judge uses to support this finding that don't rise to the evidence, rise to the level of it being substantial evidence. What we have from the record and what is actually summarized by the immigration judge is that Ms. Dembele went to the U.S. passport office there with friends, and they helped her prepare the application. They got her pictures, and then they presented it to the authorities when it was discovered. Now, Ms. Dembele was asked at that same hearing if she presented the passport application, and she responds, I did not present it. At the same hearing, then the immigration judge remarks to the government's attorney that the FBI rap sheet, which they had submitted, tells me nothing. Now, presumably acknowledging that he does not have enough information to make his finding, the immigration judge then continued the case. He at that point did not make any sort of specific finding or let Ms. Dembele know that the evidence which she had presented was not going to be sufficient or that he was going to find it to be incredible. So at a subsequent hearing, the immigration judge then references 18 U.S.C. Section 1542, which requires that one must have a specific intent to submit a false statement. After these two hearings, then, we are presented with no further documentation or testimony. Yet, at the final hearing, the immigration judge now somehow magically concludes that no further testimony or evidence is needed, and he has a sufficient basis to make a finding against Mrs. Dembele. Now, the government's brief repeatedly states that the petitioner had clearly stated that she had in fact submitted a false passport application. We do not have, what's important here to remember is that we do not have the actual passport application in this case. We don't know who filled it out. We don't know what information was provided on that application. We don't know who signed it. And we ultimately then do not know who presented it to the passport officials themselves.
She testified, though, that she went to the passport office with friends to obtain a passport in the name of Nicole Tate, the daughter apparently of a friend, but using her photo. Why isn't that enough?
Your Honor, we would submit that she stated that she did go with friends to the passport office, but whether or not the actual act of submitting the passport application and what information was contained in that passport application, we're unaware of in this case. So it's not enough just to rest based upon her testimony. And when she was asked directly by the immigration judge, did she submit it? She said, no, I did not present it.
Well, I was asking you about the finding of the immigration judge, and the court basically says it reviewed her testimony, was satisfied that she responded, that she willingly and knowingly presented a false application to the passport office, and it's clear, later on he says it's clear she used the birth certificate of a friend and submitted photographs with an application, and he makes an implicit finding that he finds her incredible. Although he doesn't make an explicit finding.
Yes, and again, this is at his final decision. He does not make an explicit finding prior to that this evidence was going to be enough to hold that she did make a false application.
So from this finding, should we conclude that he rejected her statement at the hearing that she didn't submit it?
Well, Your Honor, it's hard to tell. Because the immigration judge makes this conclusion, yet he does not present or let Mrs. Dembele know which aspects of her testimony or the documents that were submitted support that conclusion. So it is really hard to tell in this case on what basis he's ultimately using what facts to make this finding.
And so your position is, since the passport was never produced, since the passport application was never produced, that he went too far in his conclusion. I mean, that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support his conclusion.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And again, the immigration judge, even at the two hearings prior to his final oral decision, states to the U.S. government attorney that he would like to have the passport application. He never asked Ms. Dembele at that point to submit something to refute the allegations that she had made a false claim to U.S. citizenship.
Well, he's not required to do that. The immigration judge doesn't have to give the applicant notice that your credibility is on the line here. That's always part of the process. And the immigration judge is also entitled to change his mind about the sufficiency of the evidence. He may think at an earlier stage that he needs to see the passport application, and upon reflection at a later stage in the process decide that it's not necessary. There's nothing improper about that.
Your Honor, I would agree that there's nothing improper about that. However, in this case, when he's attempting to make a finding and he needs substantial evidence in order to support his finding, then the lack of there being a passport application is telling here. And also the fact that there was ultimately no conviction, which arose from her, you know, this arrest or detainment. Again, we don't even know if it was an actual arrest. We know that she was detained and questioned at the passport office, that she was held there for 1 or 2 hours, and her fingerprints were taken. But there's absolutely no following or resulting conviction from that. So,
go ahead.
So that is also telling with respect to whether or not there's substantial evidence here to support that she made a false claim.
I want to ask you in a different area. Why didn't she raise the issue of female genital mutilation in her first petition for asylum?
Well, Your Honor, and again, this is a key aspect which the board ignores in their decision and the immigration judge does not raise. Mrs. Dembele testified that, and she also had documents to support, that female genital mutilation in the tribe which she belongs to occurs to a female child at the age of 6 years. Now, at the time that her initial asylum application was presented to the immigration judge, her daughter was 2 years, and I will point out that the board incorrectly states that the daughter was 4 years of age. She was, in fact, about 2 years of age. So at that point, the fear which she had that her daughter would be subject to this practice had not manifested at that point. And she also had, again, as I stated, submitted documentation from human rights organizations in the Ivory Coast to show that within this specific tribe that it occurs to females at the age of 6 years.
You're into your rebuttal time now.
Okay, thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Webbings?
May it please the Court, my name is Jennifer Levings, and I'm from the United States Department of Justice. I represent the Attorney General in this matter. Substantial evidence here supports the immigration or the board's determination that petitioner falsely submitted an application for a United States citizen passport, and the evidence of record does support that decision. Here we have a petitioner who represented herself as someone else. She admits to that. And I would direct this court to take a look at the actual testimony, which can be found at page 146 through 149 of the record. She specifically asked, did you use the name Nicole Tate to apply for a United States passport? Yes, sir, to go over to see my mother to come back. She's again asked, did you go to the U.S. passport office and apply for a U.S. passport? Is that what happened? Yes, they took me there. The only thing the immigration judge believed her on all of this. He's not finding that she's not credible on these issues. What he's really not buying is that, and I don't even know if it's he's not buying it, but that she's forced, that somehow she's saying that she just went along with her friends and did this. I mean, other than that, the immigration judge is accepting her testimony that, yes, she did go to the United States Passport Application Office. She did use her friend's daughter's name to apply for United States passport. She submitted her picture, or at least gave it to her friends to submit. And we don't really know. She seems to be, you know, she says she did submit an application, but now when questioned further, she's trying to minimize what she did by saying, well, I just gave it to my friend, and apparently the friend walked over to the actual window and gave it to her. We're not sure.
Well, how do you explain the immigration judge's statements at the first hearing that he didn't have enough evidence at that time to determine her admissibility?
Well, at the first hearing, it's clear that the immigration judge isn't sure what the former INS counsel was trying to raise. He's not sure, are they trying to say that this was actually a crime involving moral turpitude, which is why he cites to the U.S. Code at 1542, 18 U.S. Code 1542, which is the willful and knowingly making a false statement. That's a federal offense. He does comment that could possibly be a crime involving moral turpitude, and then he advises petitioner's counsel that it doesn't appear that that's what government is now saying. And there's a series of three hearings here. It was the first hearing where the immigration judge was very confused as to what INS counsel was trying to say with regards to this testimony on the false application. At the second, I believe it's the September 4th, 2003 hearing, he tells the immigration or the INS counsel that they can further develop the record if they want, and it's there where he's saying he believes that what they're trying to say is that she committed the 212, actually 8 U.S.C. 1182A6C2II offense of the false representation to get a U.S. passport versus a crime involving moral turpitude. So he's just trying to weigh what INS is trying to do with this charge. He does come back later, as the court has recognized, he does come back later and he decides he doesn't need that. And specifically, if you take a look at the immigration statute, you don't need a conviction for false representation. Certainly her statements that she made, that she did in fact walk into a United States passport office and apply for a United States passport using a false name, combined with the FBI rap sheet that the INS counsel did submit showing that she was actually arrested at the passport office, is enough. There's no conviction required. So at the point when the immigration judge was asking for further to look at the passport application, and he even asked petitioner's counsel if she could get anything to rebut that there had been a conviction, anything, because the FBI rap sheet did indicate that there was an arrest. So we don't know. She'd already advised the immigration judge that she'd never been convicted of anything, not the felony theft. You know, she had never used a false name, which she later admitted, yes, I did commit a felony theft, and yes, I did use a false name. So at the point when the immigration judge was asking for these additional documents, this was a point where petitioner had told the immigration judge, I've never been convicted of anything, I've never used any false name, and had finally admitted that she had used a false name. So he was just looking for extra information on that so he could figure out where they were going with this. But when you go back to the statute, which is what he did at the final hearing, the statute just requires that any alien who falsely represents himself or herself to be a citizen of the United States is inadmissible. So as soon as she did that, she was inadmissible.
And has her passport ever turned up the passport application?
It appears.
I know it wasn't.
Excuse me, Your Honor. At the last hearing, the INS counsel did say that they were able to talk to State Department. It appears that the application had been transferred from Chicago to D.C. and that they couldn't get it in time for that last hearing, but that they could present it at a later date, that the Washington, D.C.'s office did have. And that's a different, again, State Department is a different entity than the former INS. So they did not have that document in their possession, but they did advise the immigration judge that it was at the State Department and they could get it a later date. And the immigration judge decided that he did not need that document because he had enough, based on her testimony, that she did in fact go to that passport office to get a passport so she could go visit her mother and use a false name. So that was enough for the immigration judge. I would like to also address, unless the court has further questions on that issue, I'd like to address the motion to reopen. Here the board clearly acted within its discretion when it denied the motion to reopen because the evidence that was sought to be offered under the regulation and the statute was not new, and it could have reasonably been presented at her asylum hearing, which was back in, she submitted her asylum application back in 1993, updated it in 1997. Her daughter was born in 1995. She was specifically on notice, even at the 1997 hearing, that female genital mutilation was contained in the State Department reports. She never said that she herself had suffered that and never mentioned anything about being afraid that her daughter might suffer that if she were, in fact, returned at that time. And in 1997, she was under the threat of deportation. So she knew if she ended up leaving the country and having to take her daughter, that her daughter could, if this was really an issue, could have been forced to undergo this procedure. So at that time, she was on notice that she needed to bring everything before the immigration judge as to her asylum claim and its impact on her daughter, which she did not do. She didn't raise that claim until years later. I think it's about 7 years later. And the board clearly found that because her daughter had been born prior to her actual hearing before the immigration judge and before her appeal to the board, she could have brought that information at that time.
If she is deported, can the father take the daughter into custody?
We don't have any testimony on that. The stepfather testified, but counsel never asked him any questions as to whether he would take the daughter. But it is clear that the daughter she's a United States citizen. She does have a father, presumably somewhere in the United States. Petitioner never said that she had contacted him, and she also has a stepfather who indicated that, you know, their marriage is strong and, you know, he was going to stick with her. So we don't know.
He's not going to Ivory Coast, though.
No, Your Honor. Not from his testimony.
The little girl either stays with stepfather, a father who may or may not be participating or at least supporting, or go back to Ivory Coast with her.
Or a petitioner could make other arrangements. And I understand this court's concerns, especially with the Alowu case, that, you know, it is an issue when parents make these statements, when petitioners make these statements that they're going to take their child back and the child could face harm. Number one, I would point out that these statements are self-serving. She's saying them because she wants the immigration judge to let her stay based on fear of what will happen to the daughter.
Yeah, but there's no dispute that this procedure takes place in that particular tribe.
There's no dispute that it takes place in that particular tribe. I would point out that in her first asylum application, she was a member of a different tribe, which she later tried to say was the same tribe. But, you know, the immigration judge on her first asylum application and her second found her not credible. So there's never been any finding as to whether the letters she submitted were credible. I mean, the immigration judge didn't go through all of that. What he did find was that she'd established hardship to her children with respect to any waiver on the theft charge, but he didn't go through a persecution analysis other than to just say, you don't, even if I granted your motion to reopen your asylum case, you haven't met your burden on whether you would be persecuted. So while there isn't a dispute, the government would just remind this court that, you know, petitioner, the child can remain in the United States. There's been no testimony that the father or the stepfather can't take the child. And petitioner's problem is that she committed this offense. She's inadmissible, and there's no waiver. Congress has made it clear there is no waiver for the false passport application. They did not take into, you know, they clearly could have said, but for hardship to the children, but they didn't. They specifically said, you're done once you commit this offense. We don't consider your children. We don't consider your spouse.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Sadiq, how much time do you have left? You got a minute left.
Just really quickly on the passport issue, it wasn't just at the first hearing that the immigration judge had asked the government's attorney to present the passport application. It was at the second, and it was ultimately also at the third hearing. And then as to the daughter Imani situation, what we do know is that, and Ms. Dembele testified to this, is that her father, her biological father, he's nowhere to be around. She hasn't had any contact with him, and that he has not paid any child support in this case. And also, the birth certificate for Imani reflects that the biological father was born in Africa, so we can't ascertain what his U.S. citizenship status would be at that time. And also, with respect to the stepfather, you know, again, there was no testimony taken as to whether or not, you know, he would be willing to look after his stepdaughter in the event that Mrs. Dembele is deported to the Ivory Coast. So with that in mind, you know, the board failed to look at Imani's particular circumstances in this case, which are very unique, in failing to reopen the case for her to present a viable claim for female genital mutilation. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. This case will be taken under advisement.